I am not in any way, shape, or form saying this is a good thing, but the economic news this week, easily on a par with politics, even as crazy as that was. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 24th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There was a point long about Tuesday afternoon or Wednesday morning, politics in this country being what it is right now, that it kind of felt like this week would never end. Am I right? Not for the first time, though, I will say this. Keep your eye on the economic news, gang. That is what's really going to last. And economic news there was this week. Anna Swanson's at the New York Times. Sadiq Reddy is at Politico. They are here to help us, I don't know what, digest. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Sadiq, let me start with you and the news of this morning anyway. The speech from Fed Chair Jay Powell out at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, the retreat that the Fed has out there every year. He gave a speech in which he said, basically, everything's fine and we're going to keep on raising rates. Anything else folks need to take away from that?
It was a steady-as-she-goes argument that he was making. The chairman of the Fed is taking it from all sides right now. He's taking it from the president of the United States, yep, who appointed him, who's saying, how dare you raise interest rates on my watch? And he's taking it from people who are looking at the stock market being extremely overextended, unemployment being low, inflation climbing, being like, are you really going to keep interest rates this low? And he's saying, well, I'm going to do what I'm going to do as long as it doesn't get too dangerous. And so he is trying to make the argument that a steady, cautious, careful approach is what we should be doing, which is, you know, not all that different from the tone of a Fed chairman from the last few decades. It just seems unusual in this moment that we're living in because everything is unusual.
Which is full of unusualness. Also unusual, Anna Swanson, the news of NAFTA this week, and I'm really glad we have you on because I want to ask you something. The word came out of the White House and negotiators this week that they were really close to a deal with Mexico on NAFTA. And I have to ask you, isn't Canada part of NAFTA as well?
That's true. Canada has been notably absent here in Washington in recent weeks as talks have been going on. And I mean, about that deal, if you had to bet over the past years that NAFTA negotiators were not going to make these deadlines that they've been talking about, you would have made your money back and then some. And I'm going to say that's what's going to happen this time again. So the United States and Mexico have been talking. They have been making some progress. And there's a chance that they could announce that they have come to an agreement on some important issues next week. But as you said, you know, NAFTA is a trilateral deal. Canada is nowhere to be seen. The Trump administration has talked about making NAFTA a deal just between Mexico and the United States. But I think that's definitely wishful thinking. You know, Mexico, Congress, and businesses are all opposed to that idea and insist that NAFTA has to be between three countries.
But Anna, let me ask you this, though. Haven't they left the really hard stuff for the end, as negotiators do, right? But they've left like country of origin and automobiles and all that stuff, that really hard stuff to the bitter end.
Yeah, I mean, negotiators like to say that, you know, nothing is done until everything is done because they tend to hold out on really tough things and wait for other countries to cave. They are definitely making some progress on the auto provisions here with Mexico. And that's part of the idea that those difficulties are mostly between the United States and Mexico, and they can do a lot on that and then bring Canada in. But there's a lot of tricky issues left still, some including like the sunset clause, which would allow NAFTA to suddenly expire unless all three countries voted to extend it.
Sadiq, speaking of other countries caving or not, let us swing our attention to the Chinese and trade, please. New sanctions went into effect on both sides this week. There have been those 301 hearings, which we're going to talk about later in the program. Ain't nobody backing down out of this puppy, right?
And who has an incentive to back down right now? The Chinese need to make sure they're being aggressive both from an economic and a geopolitical perspective. And guess what? We've got an election coming up, and nobody in the United States wants to look like they're backing down. So this is one of those things where it's probably gotten kind of dangerous already, and they're going to keep – China's going to announce more tariffs. Trump is going to fire back with more tariffs, and they'll keep firing these volleys until it gets – a little scary to both sides, a little scarier to both sides, and then they can come together and maybe do a big deal, or maybe we'll be in an economic meltdown. Yeah. Meltdown by then, who really knows? But there isn't a whole lot of incentive to fold at this stage.
All right, so let me conflate two things here and then ask each of you the same question. I want to get everybody thinking about the interview that President Trump did with Fox and Friends this week, where he said, if I get impeached, the stock market's going to crash and everybody's going to be poorer. And also the conviction of Paul Manafort, the president's former campaign chairman, and the confession, the guilty plea of his former lawyer, Michael Cohen. And everybody saying, oh, my goodness, if the president, not everybody, but the president saying, listen, this is going to be terrible and everybody's going to wind up worse. I have a thesis that goes like this. Corporate America has gotten what it wants out of the Trump administration. It's gotten deregulation and it's gotten tax reform. And then if political things happen, things will pretty much stay the course. Sudeep, weigh in on that for me, would you?
They would stay the course under President Trump and definitely under a President Pence. And people in corporate America and investors must be looking at this and thinking, wait a second, I could get all of this from the Republican Party, but without the threats against North Korea and Iran and all these things that could destabilize the global economy and create a shock that hits a 10-year-old economic expansion, maybe I would be okay with that. So what the president is saying is obviously in his interest to make it sound like, oh, this is going to be big and scary, but there's a difference between correlation and causation, and eventually people will come to realize what that is.
Anna, as the global trade policy reporter, go ahead. Sorry, weigh in.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I don't think it's great for markets either. But, you know, so far, the market has been pretty resilient to the president's troubles. And in online prediction markets right now, the probability that the president will be impeached at some point has already gone nearly as high as 50%.
Wow.
So, you know, it's more about, you know, solid corporate earnings, the tax cut, the strong economy. And if you look back, also Clinton's impeachment also had little impact on the market as well.
Anna Swanson at The New York Times, Sudeep Reddy at Politico, and another week in this economy. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
All right, on Wall Street this Friday, traders going into the weekend on a high note. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One hesitates to invoke the Internal Revenue Code without good cause because, you know, taxes and all. But there were developments this week in the continuing interpretation of the big changes to the tax code that passed last year, specifically the bits about state and local taxes and how much of them we can deduct. Turns out the Treasury Department says probably not really all that much. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra explains.
Let's say you pay $30,000 a year in state and local taxes. In the old days, when tax time rolled around, you could deduct that amount on your federal tax form. The new tax law capped that deduction at $10,000. That's a pretty small amount if you make a lot of money and live in a high tax state like New York, New Jersey, or Connecticut.
You might have more state and local taxes than you can claim under the deduction.
Jared Walczak is an analyst at the Tax Foundation. Democratic governors in some of these places said their states were being targeted by the GOP tax law. So they came up with workarounds. They passed laws allowing taxpayers to essentially pay their state and local taxes in the form of charitable contributions to the state.
You were still paying the government. It was just calling it by a different name.
And the name was the key. If you call something a charitable contribution, that means taxpayers can deduct it on their federal taxes with no limit. Michael Savage at the accounting firm 1-800-Accountant says his clients have been asking whether they can do this.
We get questions every day, all day long, about it.
But now the Trump administration is saying, not so fast.
And so the Treasury Department is saying, we see this as a way to evade taxes. They will not accept this as a charitable contribution.
The new rules aren't final yet. A handful of states have already sued over state and local taxes. Kim Rubin at the Tax Policy Center says states could sue again.
And then it could be thrown into the courts to decide whether the IRS has overstepped its role.
And Rubin says even if those states lose, they'll probably look for new ways to get around the limit. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Today is day 5 of the hearings in front of the U.S. Trade Representative that we've been covering this week. The topic at hand, as I mentioned to Sudeep, being the next chunk of tariffs on Chinese imports the White House wants to impose, 25% taxes on $200 billion worth of goods. Those are the hearings. You might remember they're originally only supposed to go 3 days, but had to double to accommodate all the corporate and industry interest. We heard on this program this week from people in high tech, fashion, packing and shipping, and automotive, most of them opposed. But let's go back, if we could, to the original tariffs on steel and aluminum and take a spin out to Granite City, Illinois, where the U.S. steel mill in town has been able to restart 2 blast furnaces and add 800 jobs.
That puts everybody in a good mood.
Yeah, it does. James Amos is the director of economic development in Granite City, which has been a steel town since 1896.
Pretty much everybody in this community knows people who currently work or have worked at that steel mill.
Amos says that in addition to the jobs at the mill, there are more than 40 heavy metal manufacturing-related companies in town and millions of dollars being invested.
Those workers, you know, they buy lunch here, they buy gas here, if they don't already live here. And so you can see a difference in our daytime population.
Here's the context of why it's such a big deal. That U.S. steel mill went from employing 2,100 people in 2015 to a skeleton crew, just about 100 people right before the tariffs were announced.
We were a community that has kind of eaten the bitter fruits of being on the wrong side of these unfair trade practices for a very, very long time.
There's a whole lot going on with all this tariff back and forth. Who's tariffing what from whom? So some confusion is to be understood. But it's not too late to get up to speed because this whole thing could go on for a while, as Sudeep was saying. Check out this new thing we've got, would you? Arewe in a trade war.com. Arewe in a trade war.com. Spoiler alert, yes. At one point, earlier this month out here in California, there were 17 big wildfires burning at the same time, including the big one you probably heard about, the Mendocino Complex fire. 400,000 acres burned so far. Firefighters from around the country, thousands of them, and as far away as Australia and New Zealand have come to help. And it's not just here either. Fires everywhere are getting bigger and more destructive and harder to contain, which means you need a lot more firefighters, which is changing the very nature of that job. Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
John Trapp was a wolf biologist in the Rocky Mountains. He was always in the field, and he wanted to spend more time with his family. 12 years ago, a job opened up at his local fire department in Red Lodge, Montana. And they told him,
you can be home every night if you want, and you may have to get up in the middle of the night and go put out a fire, but you can be home every night.
So Trapp, now 47, became a firefighter. In the beginning, he stayed close to home. But as he got more experienced, he would help fight big wildfires wherever he was needed. Now that there are so many big fires, Trapp is away from home more than he was during his days as a wolf biologist.
It's hard, and I try to front load all my family activities the first part of the summer before the fire season really gets into full swing.
He spoke to me from an airport. He was heading home after back-to-back tours in northern Montana and Oregon. His daughter was about to celebrate her 12th birthday. I asked him if he had known he'd be away so much, would he have chosen this work?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I'm in a good place right now where I'm trying to find that balance. But I think for a majority of firefighters, that's a very difficult balance to find.
Difficult because
we are seeing more fires, more catastrophic, what we call catastrophic wildfires.
Randy Brooks is a forester who teaches fire science at the University of Idaho. He says wildfires are natural, but a combination of factors, including drought, advances in fire suppression, and climate change, are creating monster blazes that can quickly engulf thousands of acres and take weeks to contain. That's made the fire season longer and fires harder to fight.
Imagine you're running a race. Years ago, it was a 100-meter dash. Now we're running a marathon. And imagine how much more energy it takes to run that marathon versus that 100-meter dash.
And Brooks says firefighters pay the price, working 12 to 16-hour days in heavy gear and often not getting enough food, water, or sleep for months on end. Some of them are contract workers and go where the money is. With hazard and overtime pay, that can be lucrative. Others, like John Trapp, work for fire departments that have mutual aid agreements with other departments. Those fighters are sent where the need is. Brick Robinson, chief for the Oceanside Fire Department in Southern California, says that can create problems back home.
So it's very difficult for me to send a lot of resources out on mutual aid assignments because I can't cover my home turf.
For the firefighters who stay behind,
you're working 24, 48, 72 hours, and there is no work rest cycle. It is just routine business.
And that makes it hard to hire. At the moment, Robinson is down 7 people in his department, and a couple of his guys are in Montana fighting those fires. But mutual aid is still the best system they have. Last year, when Oceanside was hit with a catastrophic fire, the department turned to other towns for equipment and manpower. And the help was there. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
That's a husband pillow. It's like comfortable for studying on your bed.
Never did know what those things were called. What every well-appointed dorm room apparently has to have in 2018. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials picked up 133 points today. 0.5% closed at 25,790. NASDAQ found 67 points, 0.8%. 79.45. The S&P 500 gained 17.6%, 28.74. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow gained 0.4%. The NASDAQ advanced 1.6%. The S&P 500 up 0.8%. Netflix rose 5.7% today after analysts upgraded that stock to buy. They said current quarter subscriber growth solidly in line or ahead of estimates. Software company Autodesk jumped 15% after quarterly sales beat estimates. Autodesk made software for designing stuff. Wall Street Journal reported U.S. authorities are investigating Microsoft over potential bribery and corruption related to software sales in Hungary. Microsoft up 0.7% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.81%. That is relatively, not, you know, in the scheme of things, but just relatively, relatively low as of late. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. I wanted to ask you to subscribe to a podcast I do with Molly Wood. It's called Make Me Smart. And this week on the show, we look at a company that's trying to build trust and a viable business model for journalism using blockchain.
We could still crash into the iceberg, but at least we'll be controlling it while we crash into the iceberg.
Subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcast.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The U.S. Open kicks off on Monday in Flushing Meadows, New York, the last Grand Slam tournament of the year. That's tennis, in case you're not a fan. There's going to be something new courtside this time around, a shot clock to make sure Serena and Rafa and the rest don't dilly-dally too long before they serve. Marketplace's Justin Ho tells us why.
Technically, Grand Slam tournaments have had rules about the clock. After a point, players have 20 seconds to serve the ball. Lisa Delpy-Narati is a professor of sports management at George Washington University. She says while the rule was in effect for years,
some referees were more strict on that rule than others.
Some players have been slower than others. Take the world's number one men's player, Rafael Nadal. Between serves, he bounces the ball with his hand, bounces it with his racket, wipes his face. Sometimes nearly a minute passes. At a recent press conference, Nadal said that's part of his game.
I can be faster, but I like to think.
At this year's U.S. Open, he'll have to speed it up. Players will have to serve within 25 seconds of a point. On the first defense, they'll get a warning, and if they do it again, they'll be penalized. Narati says tennis is just following a trend.
Baseball's trying to speed up the game. All sports are trying to speed up the game.
That's because there's a lot of competition for TV viewers. They can tune out when games are slow. But faster games might not appeal to everybody.
What a lot of tennis fans enjoy is probably the exact opposite of what might appeal to a national audience or a global audience.
That's sports journalist Keith Strudler. He says passionate viewers of the game love long, grueling matches.
The casual fan wants something different.
Namely, star power. The matchup between Sloane Stephens and Madison Keys in last year's women's final helped drive up ratings. Ratings for the men's final between Nadal and Kevin Anderson were down. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Even with college tuition being what it is, one doesn't normally think of higher education as a business opportunity, but perhaps one should. Consider for a moment all those incoming freshmen. Gone are the days when maybe a faded comforter from childhood or a couple of posters from the bedroom at home were good enough. Students these days, well, they're more sophisticated. They want fancier accommodations and high thread count sheets. Which gets us back to the aforementioned business opportunity, what retailers call ready-to-go merchandise delivered straight to school. Marketplace's Renata Sago has that story from Orlando.
It's move-in day. Students and parents haul hand trucks across the lobby of the freshman dorm at the University of Central Florida. It's the start of a new and scary chapter for 4,000 first-year students. Belle Staffiero is moving in her daughter, Gabrielle. This will be the 18-year-old's first time away from Westchester, New York. But she has everything to make her 170-square-foot dorm room feel like home.
She practically brought her whole closet.
She's got velvet hangers, space savers, and a box. There's a Brita pitcher.
And look at this thing.
That's a husband pillow. It's, like, comfortable for studying on your bed.
Oh, and she had to have the UGG comforter.
Gabrielle received a dorm checklist as soon as she got her room assignment from the university. Her mom shipped some items, others they ordered online for in-store pickup. And while inside the store, they got sidetracked.
Every time we were walking down the aisles, oh, I need this, oh, I need this.
Gabrielle's mom says she spent more than $700 in three stores. Her money is part of the $25.5 billion consulting group Deloitte estimates parents will spend on dorm and school supplies this year. Rod Seitz heads retail distribution analysis at Deloitte. He says retailers are starting to
realize how big the actual season is.
Big box stores have created sections where parents and their kids can pick up a desk stapler, a shower caddy, blankets, pillows, all in one swoop. Online retailers are offering bundles. In one click, you can get any customized variety of
things like comforters, bedding, might be night lights. It could be storage units. We've seen much more focus, especially for incoming freshmen.
Sides says parents spend on average $1,000 to $1,400, and that's mostly at brick-and-mortar stores. They can walk in and see what they're buying. But since we're talking room decor, we're also talking a niche market. Jeff Goronsky says high demand for specialty items in one click have opened the door to a handful of online dorm room outfitters like his, Dormco.
We carry hundreds and hundreds of styles of different comforters.
He says one of the company's top sellers is its 44-piece College Essentials dorm set, which comes with bed risers, custom bath towels, and even a loofah. Goronsky also partners with universities to deliver dorm and school supplies right to campus, a different landscape from when he started the business in 2004.
It was really more almost treating it like you're going away to camp. Oh, you're going away for the semester. We'll see you in the summer. And now it's treated as like the teenager or young adult's first home.
College costs more. Students are traveling farther. Some companies are seeing this trend as an opportunity to expand their reach. Chanel Wazirali started Roomify in 2013, selling dorm supplies. Now, the online retailer offers themed apartment decor with items that change throughout the year. Customers can text orders, and local service reps are college students. He says the idea is for them to get used to the convenience.
And feel like, you know, we're that one service provider that they want to come back to.
Who says you don't need bedding beyond graduation day? I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Not to be a downer or anything, but once you finish college, you're probably going to spend at least a couple of years working in a cubicle loathed by modern office workers far and wide. But the idea of the cube started with some really good intentions. We've got a really interesting history of the modern cubicle. Seriously, all you have to do is say, "Make me smart," to your Amazon Echo. This final note on the way out today, you know, it's not often I surrender the end of this program, but Robin Leach only dies once, as he did today at the age of 76. Who, I hear you ask, was Robin Leach? Maybe this will ring a bell.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Robin Leach with those champagne wishes and caviar dreams. We all look forward to joining you on the next edition of Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
I mean, could you be more 1980s? But I got to tell you, I did spend a distressing amount of time watching that program. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 133 points today, 0.5%. NASDAQ, 67 points to the good, 0.8%. S&P 500 gained 17. That is 0.6% on that particular index. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.